Morning, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We'll start today with a visit to the Gilmore Homes. The Baltimore Housing Authority is facing an investigation and demands for change from residents and politicians amid allegations that some tenants have been victims of sexual abuse by some maintenance workers. We'll visit the home of a Gilmore resident and speak with a community organizer and a scholar who studies urban housing. Then, a look back at WANN, a radio station in Annapolis that began in the 1940s, playing jazz and dance music to a growing African-American middle class. And producer Jonna McCone visits an expungement clinic with a woman who has struggled to find a job because of a felony charge she received more than 10 years ago. We're with her as she takes her first step in removing that charge from her record. Plus, a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving holiday. Last spring, Freddie Gray was apprehended near the Gilmore Homes public housing project in Sandtown, Winchester, one of Baltimore's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. His death, while in police custody, focused a lot of attention on Sandtown and the many challenges that residents there face, including the conditions at the Gilmore Homes. In late September, allegations surfaced that women who live in Gilmore Homes were assaulted by maintenance workers who demanded sex in return for doing routine repairs in their apartments. In light of those allegations, producer Jonna McCone and I went to the Gilmore Homes, where we met Perry Hopkins. He's an organizer with Communities United, a group that advocates on behalf of the residents.
We're going to cut through. We're going to run past the rental office. You notice that you got a church, that corner building we looked at, right? Was a like a senior center that really helps out veterans.
Gilmore Homes is in the heart of Sandtown. Public housing has been here since the 1940s.
We're walking basically through the center of Gilmore Homes. Okay, we're on our way to a residence unit.
We walk to a two-story row house.
Hi.
Taisha Harrell is 31 years old. She lives in a three-bedroom unit with her five children, including seven-month-old twins and her sister. She's lived here for 4 years. She leads us into her tiny kitchen. There are holes in the walls where electrical outlets have been ripped out. Instead of a smoke detector, wires hang from the ceiling. Another part of the ceiling is falling in. So you've had a problem with water damage in the ceiling.
And mice in the ceiling.
And mice.
Yeah, so they eat through them. The ceiling.
And then the electrical socket. What happened with that?
My daughter was standing here washing the dishes. Next thing, sparks, smoke, and popping noises just start coming out. And then I run in here. Once she tell me, come in, you just see the smoke and stuff coming out the socket. My first reaction was to call the fire department. Mm-hmm. Fire department came. My power was off. They said the wiring is faulty.
I asked Taisha how she heats her home.
With my oven.
Your oven. Your oven is heating the whole apartment or just the kitchen? Or what's
just the downstairs. And if we have all the doors closed, it'll heat up the upstairs.
Are there radiators in the other rooms or electrical things for heat that are supposed to work that just don't? Or
yes.
And they just don't work?
They just don't work. Anytime we get, like last week when it was real cold, we had to open that oven because they still didn't turn our heat on.
And so you turn the gas oven on and you open the door, right? So that the heat comes out of the oven, and that's your only source of heat here in the kitchen and in the living room.
Yes, and blankets.
And the bedrooms, how do you heat those?
I leave my room door open and have the other doors crack so the heat could go upstairs.
The heat from the oven. Going up the stairs to the bedrooms up there.
Yes.
Yeah. Taisha Harrell showed us around the rest of her home. We saw huge holes in the wall of one of the children's bedrooms, caused, she said, by rodents. We saw tiles falling off the walls, and evidence of cockroach infestation. The toilet leaks. The city's public housing stock needs more than $800 million in repairs, far more than the Housing Authority's budget and the $13 million invested in the Gilmore Homes back in the early 1990s. We've invited Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano to the show to address the Housing Authority's failure to act on allegations of sexual abuse and the conditions in public housing. He has declined. He says that they will overhaul their work order system and hire more than 80 people to address overdue repairs. Since we first reported this story last month, the Housing Authority has been under investigation by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. After that visit, we spoke with Eva Rosen, a postdoctoral fellow in Johns Hopkins University's Poverty and Inequality Research Lab, and with Perry Hopkins, the community organizer who showed us around earlier. I asked Perry what he heard from residents initially when he began organizing in the Gilmore homes.
Originally, I heard the maintenance man should just come to fix stuff and stop worrying about me, okay? I began to hear it more and more, a little more graphically, a little more explicitly. It wasn't until we held our first community meeting, and honestly, the room was pretty much, we had mostly women. And when I asked for community problems, not individual problems, that we as a community and a group could solve, this took up more time and discussion than any other subject.
So it sounds like this has been going on for a while. This is not a new problem.
Yeah, and what I used as a basis in verification of that was a lot of the residents that were speaking had been there for many, many years. There was also a cry that it's always been that way. Girl, you know, that's been going on for years. It was that type of an acceptance almost.
We should make note that Taisha Harrell, whom we spoke with yesterday, is not part of this lawsuit. She's not one of the people making
Very fortunately, she is not.
Yeah. Eva Rosen, how did public housing in this city and cities around the country get to be in such deplorable shape?
So in the 1990s, Congress created the National Commission on Severely Distressed Public Housing to actually investigate the state of public housing across the country. And what they found was that there were a significant number of units that really were what they called severely distressed. So what that meant was two things. It meant that families were living in extreme poverty in many cases, living in neighborhoods that were very poor with few jobs and high crime very often. And secondly, it meant that the actual physical state of the buildings was just in a really deteriorated condition. And so as a result of this, we saw a lot of high-rise public housing torn down all over the country, especially in Baltimore. But we still have places like the Gilmore Homes and various low-rises and some high-rises that still exist that house some of the city's poorest residents. But what we see is that these buildings are still, despite the money, some of the money that we've put into them, often in really poor condition. I've seen all of the conditions that we just heard about. I've seen residents who not only who had bed bug infestations, but elderly and disabled residents who have to wait 20 minutes at a time just to get in the elevator to go downstairs and go grocery shopping or see the doctor.
There are approximately 1,500 unanswered work orders.
In Gilmore Homes alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, lately, since Communities United has been working in the neighborhood and we have brought light to the living conditions, we have challenged a lot of their processes on regard of the resident, using the residents to step forward. It's a lot of quick fixing going on.
Eva Rosen, not all residents who are living in subsidized housing in Baltimore are living in public housing units. There's, of course, the Section 8 program that has private landlords providing housing. What's your research on the private landlords in Section 8 and how successful that is?
When it comes to the question of providing safe, affordable housing, we worry about public housing residents, but we also worry about other subsidized renters, like those who receive vouchers, and especially about also folks who don't receive any assistance. Only a quarter of families who qualify actually receive assistance. So I've studied low-income residents and landlords in Baltimore in particular, to try to think about this transition that we've seen in the past 20 years to some degree away from public housing towards using vouchers to allow families in theory, to choose a home in the private market that's affordable and that works for them. And policymakers hoped that they would get to neighborhoods that were maybe better neighborhoods than public housing has historically been located in, neighborhoods and units that were perhaps in better condition than public housing was and is. What this means is that we see this sort of whole new actor who's introduced into the scene, right? So the private landlord is a whole new person with his or her own needs and desires and motivations. And so we might worry about what kinds of regulations there are or aren't in that setting that's a bit more in the private market. In some ways, we might worry that this could happen even more in a setting like that.
So, Perry, you've been organizing in Sandtown for about 6 months now.
Yeah.
Obviously, these allegations of sexual abuse are terribly serious and will be litigated because now a lawsuit has been begun. What are the other priorities for the residents there in the short term and then looking a little further out?
Well, currently, along with the input of the residents, Communities United has been circulating a petition for some immediate need fixes. We've asked that all of the security lighting on the outside, exterior lighting, be made operable. Because when the sun goes down, if you were to walk down that sidewalk in 15 seconds, if I walk behind you, you'd be invisible. We've also had a break-in that was under camera, and I have a Baltimore City police officer on tape stating if the lights outside were on, they would have been able to clearly identify the subject, but only had shadows. Second, we're asking that all of the electrical sockets in those units be equipped with a circuit breaker or GFI because the wiring is so old.
So they have fuse boxes in many of these apartments.
They have fuse boxes in almost every one of them. And thirdly, in light of the winter coming in, the number of children and families currently inhabiting that complex, do you know that over 3/4 of those units are single-paned windows? There's one tiny piece of glass between the elements and a family with, as we've heard, unworking heat. So we've asked that those three things be addressed immediately. So far, we've got no response.
Is this a matter, Eva Rosen, simply of, you know, money being available? Or do you suspect that this has something to do with political will as well?
I think that money is a big part of it. I think that since public housing was created in the 50s and 60s, we have not seen the federal government willing or able, that's a whole other story, but we have not seen enough money invested to maintain the housing infrastructure that we have. And these problems have come and gone throughout the history of public housing. When we put families in situations, particularly in poor housing conditions, is it puts them in a really systematically vulnerable position where this kind of exploitation can flourish. And if we want to change that, we need more oversight, and we need to change some of these on the ground daily operations of the way these housing projects are managed. But we also need to consider whether or not we're willing to actually invest in maintaining these buildings.
Well, I appreciate both of your coming in and helping us shed some light on this. This is something we will continue to take a look at. So we will be in touch with both of you in the future. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Perry Hopkins works in Sandtown, Winchester with Communities United. Eva Rosen is a postdoctoral fellow in Johns Hopkins University's Poverty and Inequality Research Lab. Since our interview, Paul Graziano has toured the Gilmore homes and appeared before the Baltimore City Council. He has promised quick action to address the problems in all of city-owned public housing. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Up next, in the 1950s, they called it race music. A look back at WANN Radio in Annapolis.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
The Maryland Morning on 881 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Now we're going to take a look back at an Annapolis radio station that broadcast music for an African-American audience for 50 years, from 1947 to 1997. Ephemera and objects from the station, WANN, are on display at the Smithsonian Museum of American History, which has a permanent exhibit that opened in July called American Enterprise, part of the museum's new innovation wing. The exhibit traces America's development from a small, agriculturally dependent country to a global economic powerhouse. It's an eclectic collection, things like an early Monopoly board game and the name tag of a shoe clerk who worked at the department store Woodward and Lothrop. To highlight the African-American experience from the consumer era, what the Smithsonian is calling the 1940s through the 1970s, they selected artifacts from WANN. Last month, I spoke with Larry Blum, the son of the founder and owner of WANN, Morris Blum. Dr. Charlie McGovern, a history professor at the College of William and Mary, also joined us. I asked Dr. Blum about how the station got its start once his father returned home from World War II.
He had been a communications officer with the United States Navy during the war, and his career goals after the war were to begin a radio station. He looked at various cities near his hometown of Baltimore, and he started a radio station in Annapolis, which was one of the few state capitals at that time that did not have a local radio station. Very quickly, the city had three radio stations. At that point, my father had a decision to make about the economic viability of a radio station facing a lot of competition in a small town. And that's where the idea of catering to an African-American audience slowly began to take hold.
And how did it start? What was the program format before he switched to that format?
It would have been general and basic radio. This was a radio station that got started before television. My father had employed at the end of the broadcast day, a disc jockey to play some records at the very last hour of the day from the local college of St. John's College. And my father had a collection of records in the back of the radio station then that his manager had advised him not to play. This was so-called race music in that time. And the manager had gone off on vacation, and my father gave the DJ the records to play for the last hour of the day. The Holy Spirit, you greet, you greet, you find joy, joy unspeakable in the Lord. Usually fan mail had been minimal. All of a sudden, within a week of putting the show on, the mailbox burst open when he opened it at the post office, with fan mail coming out from all over the Chesapeake Bay region, from Baltimore, southern counties, eastern shore. So clearly my father realized there is an audience that wants to be entertained.
Yeah, the market proved itself. And Dr. Charlie McGovern, obviously Annapolis was segregated, Maryland and the country was segregated in the 1940s and the 1950s, but I guess the airwaves weren't. How did that work in terms of crossover between a white and a black audience?
The airwaves weren't segregated in the sense that you could turn the dial, but the stations that catered to African-American sounds were located all the way at one end or the other of the dial, the lower frequencies. In any city you went to in the 1950s, you could in effect find black voices and black music literally by spinning the dial all the way to one end or another. In that sense, people knew where to find those voices and that music. It was a lot easier to hear black music and for African Americans to hear the voices of their community speaking to them about their interests than it was for African Americans and whites to associate socially. And of course, there were many prohibitions in the North as well as the South.
Did stations like WANN, both here and around the country, did they have many white listeners?
One of the reasons that most stations began to cater to African American listeners was because they saw that market as untapped and, of course, very likely to be loyal, especially if the stations played the music that the people wanted to hear and had personalities who addressed them in ways that they wished to be addressed and spoke to their concerns. But increasingly, over time, white Americans picked up on the music especially. It wasn't surprising that most of these were young people because that music became, of course, the roots of what eventually we came to know as rock and roll. So there was a sense of attraction for a lot of young people. This music was different. It was exciting. It had a vibrancy that sometimes was missing from the general pop music of the day.
And Dr. Blum, I want to talk about a particular personality who was on WANN. This is Hoppy Adams. He was a DJ there for many years, and during the summers, he used to broadcast shows from a place called Cars Beach. Tell us that story.
Hoppy Adams had been hired by my father, at first as a part-time disc jockey and then later full-time. He actually had worked in other radio stations briefly before coming to work for my father. He already had been a bit of a local personality. He came from a very prominent African-American family in Annapolis, and he was an athlete, though impaired by polio. His gait was impaired, but he was an excellent swimmer, thus the name Hoppy. Cars Beach was a segregated beach near Bay Ridge, Annapolis. The beaches, of course, in that era were completely segregated. There were two African-American beaches that catered to African-American audiences and patrons on weekends. One was considered, quote, the family entertainment beach, unquote. That was Sparrow's Beach. Cars Beach had acts that were more secular in nature and was open to African-Americans, though whites were and other races were certainly allowed to attend if they wanted to.
We have a clip from Hoppy Adams broadcasting on WANN.
Hey, how would you like to see all the top recording stars this summer? Well, you can at Cars Beach in Annapolis. This season will be...
Dr. Blum, you went on to a career as a medical neurologist. When you were a kid, did you have a personal recollection of meeting Hoppy Adams? What kind of guy was he?
Well, quite well. I worked at the radio station as a teenager and young adult. But I actually worked in the radio station as a news person, broadcasting the news for Hoppy, doing the engineering, answering the doors, helping him get his records ready. So in the summer times, I did all of that for him. He was very charismatic, particularly on the air. He had a lot of presence and a lot of dignity.
Dr. McGovern, the exhibit at the Smithsonian breaks this notion of the American enterprise into these broad chunks of time. They call one the merchant era, the corporate era. They talk about the consumer era, which they basically date from the 40s to the 70s. What does that entail? What does that mean?
The American economy emerged after World War II as dominant in no small part because it was the last one standing, so to speak. It had not experienced the same kind of devastation that most of the other powers in the war had done. And also, the economy was what some scholars have called Fordism. It was based on mass production and mass distribution, and things were geared toward the assumption that if you made good quality products at a low enough price, you could sell many of them. And thus the working class who made the products could also afford to buy them. And that was the formula that carried American business through the middle decades of the century, eventually replaced more and more by what we might think of as niche marketing rather than trying to reach everyone with the same product to really peg things to different economic levels and to different, if you will, cultural position. But from the 40s to the 70s, the United States economy was dominant because they had an equitable distribution of income, much more so than now, and because they were able to produce products at prices that working class wage workers were able to afford.
And Dr. Blum, we have a picture of a flyer that WANN Radio distributed to potential advertisers talking about the fact that its African-American audience was the largest outside of New York. Your dad was white, you know, you're white. Growing up, did you get a sense that it was unusual for a white man to own a radio station that catered to the black market?
Well, initially, no. When you're a small child, you sort of take it in stride. You figure this is one part of the world. I can say that thanks to the experience of having been part of WANN, I wasn't exposed in the context of work and family to some of the issues that were going on in society. I didn't see some of the tensions that were going on. As I got older, I began to realize not everybody enjoyed what we were doing. Not everybody approved. There were a lot of people that would make disparaging remarks or who would keep their distance from our experience. At times, extraordinarily cold, to say the least, as to the reception Annapolis gave my father and gave the radio station. So in a sense, we were living in our own world.
Please don't go home. Oh, never leave me, baby.
Please don't go.
Was it financially viable? Was it successful?
I'd say that in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, we were doing very well. By the early 80s, not as well. All pioneers, whatever they may be a pioneer in, find that at some point they're beginning to get a bit outmoded. Also, radio was changing. There was a lot more competition. Deregulation in the early 80s allowed for radio stations to pop up all over the dial, both in the AM and FM frequency. FM began to become more dominant.
Yeah, so there are a lot of other market forces affecting this, yeah. And Dr. McGovern, is WANN unusual? Is it unique?
It was not unusual at all for African-American-oriented radio stations to be owned by whites. In fact, when Mr. Blum started WANN, there was only one radio station owned by an African-American, and that was in WERD in Atlanta. By the end of the 1950s, there were only three stations owned by African-American. So the control of these businesses was in the hands of whites. That said, it was possible by the early 1960s to drive across the country through a southern route, if you would, and hear black people on the air all the time you were driving, if you basically drove during the day. That's how many stations were catering to African-American audiences. There were many, many stations that devoted some substantial portion of their airtime to having African-American voices on the air and broadcasting black music, essentially for black people.
And talk about this notion of race music and the crossover that eventually occurred. I mean, it's famously remembered by about Sam Phillips, the guy that discovered Elvis Presley, that he was specifically looking for a white singer who sounded black. And of course, you alluded to earlier the influence of so-called race music, black music, on what became American rock and roll. Where does that stand in this arc of history?
The same kind of Jim Crow that was in American society was also being used to categorize American music, even though we had and have plenty of evidence that African Americans and whites listened to one another, shared and stole traditions from one another. And again, of course, African Americans had much less power in this. Even though the music was mixed, the categories were separated. The idea that something was made by an African-American meant that it was largely geared to African-Americans. There were, of course, many important exceptions, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, among them. So race music was a slightly derogatory term that increasingly became more and more derogatory as African-Americans' freedom struggle grew in the 1940s. By the end of the 1940s, black performers like Lionel Hampton were rebelling against that term. They just wanted their music to be known as music and not have any race label attached to it. But that music was still largely segregated from white ears. You might hear Ellington or Lionel Hampton on a pop station, but you wouldn't hear H-Bomb Ferguson, or you wouldn't necessarily hear the Orioles out of Baltimore. That was music that was still geared toward African Americans. And it was the radio stations that broke that barrier down, because they didn't attract white listeners. And eventually the people who made the records realized that there was a broader audience for it. It was very much true that as white musicians openly acknowledged their debts to African-American sounds and traditions, they drew a broader audience in for their music. And that's really how the barriers began to break down. A lot of it was commerce. You know, it wasn't about civil rights per se, but the market in that sense is very important. People will sometimes chase green where they will not necessarily be comfortable with mixing black and white.
Dr. Larry Blum is a medical neurologist and the son of Morris Blum, the founder and owner of WANN Radio. Dr. Charlie McGovern helped curate the American Enterprise exhibition at the Smithsonian. He's a professor of American Studies and History at the College of William and Mary. I spoke with them both in October. I'm Tom Hall. Ahead on Maryland Morning, the story of a Baltimore mother and activist working to clear her criminal record.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Last month, we looked at a set of laws that went into effect in Maryland that would allow certain misdemeanors, as well as crimes that are no longer criminalized, like possession of small amounts of marijuana, to be shielded from public view or, in some cases, expunged. The law could impact tens of thousands of people who've been charged with or done jail time for these types of crimes. Carrying a criminal record can adversely affect nearly every aspect of a person's life, employment and housing, and even the right to vote. Jonna McCone visited an expungement clinic in northwest Baltimore with Danielle. She's a Baltimore resident who is looking to expunge her criminal record under the new legislation.
These are going to be painted, and I'll.
Danielle makes art in her apartment in northwest Baltimore. We're surrounded by colorful painted vases, patterned fabric, and her children's artwork.
And a lot of my items are literally trash. Like, you know, I find things everywhere.
Danielle, who is 37 and a mother of seven, has struggled to support her family. Over the last decade, she's worked a patchwork of jobs as an artist, hairdresser, and baker. But her sporadic income is not by choice. After an arrest in 2002, she's had a hard time finding full-time employment.
I was in an abusive relationship, and during an attack, I fought back. And once the police arrived, they informed me that I would be arrested as well.
When the police got to the scene, Danielle and her ex-boyfriend both had minor injuries. At the time, they were each struggling with drug addiction. In the end, she was charged with
2 separate counts of deadly weapon with the intent to injure and 1 second-degree assault charge.
The deadly weapons in Danielle's possession were a lamp and the top to a glass table. She spent 3 days in jail before being released on bail. And though she was charged with a felony, the case never went to court, and she was never convicted. Earlier this month, a set of laws went into effect allowing people like Danielle to get those charges removed from public view. On that day, she headed to a clinic where dozens of attorneys were helping people figure out if they were eligible.
I'm having my record as far as today.
After 13 years of having a record,
let me call them.
Danielle is sparkling with anticipation.
Here for expungement stuff. All right, here's a clipboard and pen. So go ahead and fill out that information on the intake for me.
There are hundreds of people here. Many had lined up outside starting at 6 a.m. In addition to removing non-convictions, the laws also allow the expungement of charges that are no longer criminal offenses. And people with some nonviolent misdemeanors, like disorderly conduct and disturbing the peace, could have those shielded from public view with court approval. Karen Aslan is senior policy advocate at Job Opportunities Task Force, a nonprofit that works to improve job skills and incomes for low-wage workers.
We're hosting this clinic to ensure that individuals can come to determine this is what your record looks like, this is what's eligible, this is what you need to do. Help them fill out court forms so that they can leave today and head directly to the courthouse and drop off their forms.
So just ask me about my income, benefits, assets, income. Are you currently employed? No. Okay. There's one page on here. I guess it's just about your charges. Any information you can provide will only assist the attorney. Do not worry if you cannot recall all of the information. But I can remember very well.
The clinic takes place in a large church in northwest Baltimore. Danielle walks downstairs to a room crowded with lawyers working at makeshift desks.
I have so much in my mind right now. I want to scream. I can't believe this is going to happen today. 13 years.
These new laws were signed by Republican Governor Larry Hogan earlier this year after being passed by the Democrat-controlled General Assembly. Democratic Delegate Curtis Anderson of Baltimore says they've been in the works for a few years.
The Second Chance Act, as well as the expungement of crimes that are no longer crimes, put a lot of time in it. The bill failed two or three times. It's been cut down a lot. But we finally did get something passed. And then to come today and just see the faces of the people who it's going to help has re-energized me to get the rest of it done.
But some people at the clinic found out they were not eligible to have their records removed. As I'm interviewing Delegate Anderson, a woman in her mid-20s walks up.
Congressman Anderson, I have a question.
Yes.
First of all, thank you for sponsoring the bill. I have a master's degree. I have 3 degrees.
Yes.
I don't have a job. I can't get my record expunged.
The woman, India, was charged with failure to stop at a stop sign following an arrest for driving with a suspended license. She was surprised to find out that she wasn't eligible to get her record cleared today.
I want to have a voice for my people. I'm very educated, and I was, you know, out here in line with everybody and speaking to everybody about what you can and cannot get expunged, but they don't know there's certain stuff they can't get expunged.
And there are many in India's position. That's one reason Karen Aslan is planning to continue to lobby in the next legislative session.
You have a whole host of other low-level misdemeanor offenses that should be eligible for shielding that are not. You have a whole host of nonviolent felony offenses. You know, possession with intent to distribute is the number one offense that Marylanders are arrested for. That's not eligible for shielding.
She says another limitation of the new laws is that when several charges result from an incident, all of them have to be eligible. Otherwise, none of them are. Aslan says charging people with several offenses at one time is a common practice in the state.
It's a strategy that's used. We charge you with all of these offenses knowing that we'll probably be able to secure a conviction on one or two.
Expanding the scope of the laws is not something many in the business community want to see happen. Before I leave the clinic, I asked Danielle what she would say to a business owner who says the right to know someone's arrest history is important.
I would say that I am not what my record says. I'm an individual first. I have a lot of trade skills, talents, and attributes that will add to the potential company I'm employed with. And also, I have full confidence in not getting into any other trouble.
Danielle and others at the clinic also used it as a chance to network and meet people facing similar challenges. That's what happened in this group during a workshop on the new laws.
We are our own best allies because we know what it's like to come out and get every door slammed in your face.
That's what I've been saying for like the past 3 hours, that
yes,
we have to stop going outside of us. It's
yes,
us right
yes,
now,
absolutely,
right here. We have a network right here that we can utilize.
At that workshop, Danielle gave out a few of her business cards as she told people about the art she makes and sells. For those who can't find work, they're determined they'll support one another.
Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah.
Producer Jonna McCone, we checked in with Danielle earlier this week. She says she has had several opportunities since applying to have her felony charge removed. And a few days ago, Danielle cashed her first check for a job since 2003. As for removing the charge from her record, in January, she'll meet with a lawyer to complete the next step in the expungement process. If you want to learn more, we have information on our website, wypr.org/Marylan Morning.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life.
That's all for us today. Nathan Sterner is our co-host, director, and engineer. Rob Sivak, Jonna McCone, and Kathleen Cahill produce the broadcast with assistance from Scott Seiss. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville provides us coffee. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. And thanks to Chris Kennedy and Clean Cuts Music for our theme song. Speaking of theme songs, we love Chris's music, but we're on the hunt for a new theme song for Marylan Morning. On our website, there are 5 samples of music provided for us by the composing team at Clean Cuts. Come over to wypr.org/Marylan Morning and let us know which one you think we should choose. Voting ends on Sunday. Coming up Monday morning on Marylan Morning, a preview of the first of the 6 Freddie Gray trials. I'm Tom Hall. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
You know how I feel. Send out the pie.